Welcome everybody to Space Force, 50 Shades of Khan. This is our first episode. Maybe it depends on how much we had to say, how long we go. Talking about Star Trek's second motion picture, The Wrath of Khan. We hope that you've enjoyed the show so far. In our second season, we're working through all of the films as we wait for the next season of Discovery to break. And with the pandemic, who knows how long that will be.
They just announced that they're delaying it.
Okay, so it has officially been delayed.
It has been delayed. They haven't given us a date, so we don't know delayed by how long, but they have postponed it. They did give us some episode titles. The most interesting title was Unification 3.
Which one is Unification Parts 1 and 2?
1 and 2, it's the Spock episode.
Yeah.
My guess is that Discovery is going to go in the fall future, and we're going to have a planet. The third planet will be like this Romulan Vulcan hybrid thing. That's my guess, just on an episode title.
So you think that it's actually also the name of a planet? It's like,
yeah, I think because it doesn't. It's not Unification comma 3 or Unification Part 3. It's just Unification 3, and I'm thinking it's the name of a planet.
So it's like the planet of galactic peace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nimbus 3. Oh my God! What if it is Nimbus?
All right.
You have no idea how happy I would be.
So, Wrath of Khan. This was not the first Star Trek film I saw, because I did see the first one, but it was the first one I went to in the theater by myself, or basically with friends. Like I didn't go with my parents to see this movie, right? Like. And I remember it came out the same year as Road Warrior. I believe that's right. Because I had a friend who worked at the movie theater, and he would get me in. And that summer I saw this film, Road Warrior, a bunch of other big films on my friend's, you know, free movie ticket. This was a big movie for me. Like to this day, this remains my favorite Star Trek film. I don't know why that is. Aside from, I know that I have watched it differently as the years have gone by. I remember reading that Kirk is supposed to be 49 in this movie, right? He's having his sort of midlife crisis. And as I myself have gotten older, I've started to see the film's discussion about age in a way that I didn't when I was, you know, 16. Seeing this film for the first time, and it was just cool fight scenes, right?
Well, we can discuss that.
Yeah.
That's the whole reason why we're here is to discuss
the thing.
Why this film is so timeless.
Yes, good. Okay, so I will shut up and ask you, why is this film so timeless?
I think it's because it's on point in terms of its themes.
Go ahead.
Like nothing is wasted. Every part of the buffalo is used.
Yeah.
I think the fact that it's a smaller story, it's budgetarily, it's more constrained.
Yeah.
I think the fact that Nick Meyer is an outsider who's like, okay, Kirk is old. Shatner is 51.
Yeah.
We need to acknowledge that, because trying to fake it in the motion picture is silly looking on the big screen. And the fact that everything is about age and mortality, even from the opening sequence when it's a test run for Savick.
Yeah.
The whole movie is a test run for Kirk in a way that he's never been tested before. That he even has to acknowledge at the end of the movie when he has broken glasses.
Yeah.
That he has never faced death in this way. And sort of like the cowboy nature of him dies in this movie.
It felt to me like he had an arc, you know, in the way that we talked about he did not have in the original motion picture.
Yeah.
Where there was an opportunity there for him to kind of acknowledge that he did not treat Decker properly and that he was doing what he was doing out of self-serving interest. But he never got to that point. But he has these realizations. It's just a better written movie. It's got real vulnerabilities, and the characters have flaws. It's so great. Nate?
It's like I've not watched this for a while. Yeah. So I put it on Monday this week.
Yeah.
And oh my God, I forgot how good it was. it's just such a good film. I thoroughly enjoyed it all the way through. I just think it's the pacing is there, the story's there, the character stuff is there. It's just so good. It's just so damn good.
You know, I watched the director's cut today, and there's little tiny little bits of dialogue that they left in.
And some of it took out.
Well, almost all of them should have been cut. Like that is the director's cut. Does not, I don't think it helps. I don't think it helps the picture at all. I think it adds lines that slow it down and create problems that the original film, the theatrical release, doesn't have to deal with.
I think the only benefit for the director's cut is that they make that engineer Scotty's nephew.
Preston, yes.
Yeah, oh, yeah,
Preston.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that's better. Like everything else, because I've seen Wrath of Khan loads of times.
Yes.
So I'm like cued into, oh, that's a new line.
Yep.
Or that line's missing. Like Colt doesn't tell Spock in this film, oh, that young man back there was my son.
Yeah.
Which he does when they're in the Jeffries tube in the original cut. And I'm like, that seems like an odd omission.
No, I think that's the line where they're in the Jeffries tube and he says, that's my son. That's the director's cut.
No, that's the theatrical because it's not in the director's cut. I watched the director's cut.
I just watched the director's cut, and it is there. All right, well, we'll have to figure this out.
But you're right. Like, there was a couple extra lines of dialogue with Chekhov and Dr. Malkus. There was a couple extra lines of dialogue in the Kulk Spock McCoy scene.
Yeah.
But it's not like the motion picture where it dramatically – like doesn't change the plot, but dramatically improves the viewing experience.
Yeah.
In fact, I kind of thought it was a little, like you said, a little sloppy.
Yeah.
I think the next time I'm just gonna watch the original theatrical cut and be like, that's just his nephew.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So the funny thing you were saying about obviously the idea we're talking about the mortality of the characters and their aging.
Yeah.
So that's obviously something we've seen in Picard. So.
That's right.
This is a similar thing, but I think the funny thing is this: as I'm watching this, and they play it up quite a lot. He's got his birthday; doesn't acknowledge he's getting old.
Yeah.
This is Shatner in 1982. Okay. Yeah. He's still around with us, but still, we were talking about his age back then. It's like it's fantastic. Yeah. It's so great. So Kurt, you're getting over here. It's like that's 40 years ago. It's just, that's nuts. It's so great. It's such a good film.
Let's talk about some of the ways about how this film came to be. Star Trek comes out. It's generally considered to be kind of underperforms for Paramount's expectations, I think, because the budget was so high. And there was a lot of reasons for that high budget. So they decided to move forward.
I can't believe it did crappy money. It just, I think the budget
shrunk
a little bit, yeah.
And they also tossed on a lot of extra things. Like,
yeah.
The production for Phase 2 should not have been rolled into it.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
and it's the same thing that like Brian Zingel has to deal with the Superman movie.
Yeah,
like because he also paid for Tim Burton's Superman movie.
Right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's ridiculous.
So the new film is given a smaller budget than the first picture, which is not how you would normally think a sci-fi sequel would go in 2020. Certainly, it's given a smaller budget. And there's a lot of different versions of the script, right? Jim, can you walk us through some of this?
Like anything that's a success, because it's a success in terms of like there was audience engagement.
Yes.
That was Paramount's big concern is there going to be an audience for Star Trek?
Right.
And they saw that there is an audience for it. Like they turned out a shitty film and a bunch of people saw it multiple times.
Yeah.
So they knew they wanted to make a sequel. So there was various drafts, about six or seven different permutations. Most drafts don't have Khan.
Okay.
Like the Genesis device becomes an item. At one point, Klingons are the bad guy.
Yeah, it's called the Amiga device in one thing, I believe, isn't it? Something like that.
Yeah. And Kulk and his David wind up having to liberate a planet together.
Right.
Like Kulk's son is like becomes this no isn't a scientist, but he's this royal who doesn't know his dad, and that becomes the big like third act reveal. So those different permutations. Finally, James Shroud is given the final screen credit for the script, even though Nick Mile rewrites him. He does a draft. Hall Bennett does a draft where he puts in Khan.
Okay.
And it includes the Genesis device, and it includes David. And so he takes all these little pieces, and then Nick Mile takes six or seven different drafts. And then over 12 days, he sits there and cranks out essentially the shooting script for this film.
And what I read was that he had not been a big Star Trek fan. He had not watched the show a lot. He wasn't really into it. And so when he decided to write it, he was like, well, okay, so this is the Space Navy. So I'm going to write it like this other book of other series of Navy books that I did read as a kid, which are the Horatio Hornblower novels. And so I'm going to write Horatio Hornblower in space. Like, okay, I know how to write that script.
This is what I thought was funny because nowadays a lot of people get really annoyed when people are handed TV films or movies when they say, well, I've never seen it. And you go, well, why the hell are you writing it then? You know, you get the comics and you get, why is that wrestler writing Spider-Man comics or something like that? It's just like, yeah, it makes no difference. So they can be fans of stuff, but they've never, And fair enough, sometimes it's true because they go, well, that was terrible. They definitely didn't know that character. This seems to be done dead on. It's just like, oh, I didn't really care for Star Trek that much. It's one of the best films out of the six. It's crazy.
Well, that and to Jason's point, like Horatio Hornblower has always been Roddenberry's go-to analogy.
Yeah.
Like, he sold Star Trek as Wagon Train to the Stars.
Yeah.
That was a series of films, and it was going to be more like the Twilight Zone in terms of it was going to be more anthology-based and less ship-based. So he's always said, like, Horatio Hornblower is Kulk. And when he met Patrick Stewart, he originally tried to give Patrick Stewart the Horatio Hornblower books. He's like, and Patrick's like, no, I read all these as a child. I know these books backwards. So the fact that Nick Mile goes, okay, I'm going to make it Horatio Hornblower in space, unknowingly, he is tapping into one of the primal conceits of the franchise.
I see.
That's on the underlying, like when you strip it of Roddenberry's pontification, it is a military style action adventure show.
So they were roots of the same tree.
Yeah,
and that's why I see that.
And it really shows in the Starship combat section.
Yeah,
that whole outmaneuvering kind of broadside, shots and that kind of thing. It really does go to kind of sailing ships in the sea. So yeah, it's pretty.
This is still like the best Starship combat. It's kind of the archetypal Starship combat movie. Star Wars always had lots of little tiny fighters dogfighting, but if you wanted big ships fighting in space, I mean, everything is compared to this movie. Anyway.
Well, it's the only film to actually acknowledge the fact that you're going to be in three dimensions. Like, that's ultimately what does Khan in.
Yeah.
The fact that he's thinking of it in terms of two galleys meeting on an ocean and duking it out that way. He's not thinking of it. And that's where Kulk shines as he goes, the Enterprise rises up and you got that beautiful shot closing in on the Reliant.
Yeah.
And it's the Jaws moment, right? Like, it's your thoughts.
I remember I was playing the board game Starfleet Battles during this time. And Starfleet Battles, is a famously difficult game because it's Star Trek designed by an engineer. So it's, you have to allocate power to all of your starship systems every turn. But I remember, of course, it's played in two dimensions on a map.
Yeah.
And so after the movie came out, they came out with new game rules to accommodate the film. And at one point it was, we're going to ignore that two-dimensional thinking crack. Right? Because that's exactly what we're playing. Like, okay. But trying to do a Starfleet Battles in three dimensions just became impossible, right? Like, how do you do that?
And even computer games, even Even computer games that are Star Trek based overlook the three dimensions. Starfleet Command, which is one of the best ship building, combat to combat ship fighting that you can get, it's still two dimensional. It still uses some of those rules from, Starfleet Battles?
Starfleet Battles, yeah.
The good thing is it also makes sense for Khan as well, because even though Khan's supposed to be this military tactician and ruled, Earth in the 90s, no experience of space combat.
Yeah.
So it does make sense. So it's not like, we just outsmarted him. So no, this guy knows everything about his environment there and then. Mm-hmm. Put him on a spaceship out in space, Kirk's going to outthink him.
And they do a very good job throughout the film of showing the difference between Kirk's experience versus Khan's sort of natural intelligence, right? And Kirk has two big moments where his experience wins. The second one is the three-dimensional thinking that Spock brings up. But the first one, of course, is the famous Shield Reliant console code command, right? When they hack Reliant, they don't use the word hack because this is 1982 or whatever, but they hack Reliant's computer to lower the shields. What's fascinating is that this is exactly the opposite of Kirk's problem in the first movie. In the first movie, his problem is he doesn't understand how the Enterprise works. That's why he tries to fire phasers at the asteroid in the wormhole instead of the photons. But in this film, he's apparently done his homework because he's flipped that script. So now he's the guy that knows everything. He even lectures to Savick, you have to learn how things work on a starship, right? And I'd be curious to know if that was done intentionally or if it's just like, well, we as fans have to come up with an explanation for why Kirk has changed over the last 10 years.
Well, so when the decision's made to age Kirk up,
yeah,
he has a whole 5-year mission from the motion picture to going back to Starfleet Command.
Yeah.
On the Enterprise. So once they made the decision, and because motion picture takes place 2.5 years after the end of the original series, they had to throw in another 5-year mission and then some admiralty duties that he did after that.
Yeah.
So he has two sessions of this under his belt.
Yeah.
So he's been in deep space for 10 years. No one's going to know the ship better than him.
Right, right.
Outside of Scotty.
Yeah. We don't get those things we have with Decker, where Decker suggests something and Kirk says, oh no, we're doing it this way instead. And proving to be better than Decker. Kirk knows what he's doing. So instead of just I'm in charge. I need to make a crappy suggestion so that Kirk can outthink me. Kirk knows what he's doing, but nobody kind of has to question him. Savick's okay to question stuff because she's a younger cadet. But the actual idea that it's like, oh, well, I'm a captain as well, that would be an issue again if Kirk just kept belittling every single captain on the starship. So
it's a great contrast between Decker, who's constantly questioning Kirk's orders in the first movie and we hate him for it, and Savick, who's constantly questioning Kirk's orders and we like her for it because she's always right. Right.
Well, even Kirk acknowledges that. Kirk doesn't shut Savick up.
Spock
shuts Savick up.
Yeah.
Kirk's away all the regulations, right when the ships are about to meet each other.
Yeah.
After that fight, after he uses the prefix code and he gets the Enterprise away, he turns to Savick and goes, you keep quoting regulations.
Right, right. Yeah.
And that's a dramatic change from where he was at, 8 years ago, however long in the continuity it was between Wrath of Khan and Motion Picture.
Yeah.
He seems to be more in control. Like, this is a more calm, composed Kirk.
It is, yeah.
As the last Kirk, I felt, we commented so much on his neediness.
Yeah, neediness.
And his clinging to this old life that he once had and he gave up.
It's an interesting contrast to Khan, too, because while Khan was a very cool, collected character in Space Seed, by Wrath of Khan, he's kind of overcome with emotion all the time, right? Like, he's kind of passionate. Because of the
death of
life and so on.
He's got the Captain Ahab obsession, isn't he?
That's right. And it's a neat contrast to Kirk, who's kind of cool, more sedate throughout the film.
So one of the things that Nick Meyer had to do, and he had to figure this out when directing William Shatner.
Yeah.
William Shatner needs 18 takes. Because the first 17 of those takes, it's William Shatner being William Shatner, Captain Kirk.
Yeah.
And by the time, as the more takes he goes through, it becomes, he stops pretending and just starts being.
Oh, yeah.
So the scene, Will, that you quoted, the prefect scene.
Yeah.
He writes in his book, Nick Meyer writes in his book, A View from the Bridge.
Yeah.
That required 18 takes. Because every time Kirk would say, here it comes, he would be like, here it comes.
Oh,
it would be that Shatner sort of glint in his eye, Captain Kirk bravado. And he was like, no, you can't do that. Because if you do that, that's sarcasm, and Khan's going to pick up on it.
He's
going
to notice. Yeah, that's right. You got to play deadpan. You got to be.
Yeah, you got to just be like, here it comes. and then it's not a thing, right? But Shatner wanted to play it up like, ha ha, I got you, fuckle. And it was a learning curve for Nick Meyer, because there was a scene in this movie that's cut, and the scene would have been giving Sulu the Excelsior. He would have been promoted to captain at the end of this movie.
Really?
Yes. And it was a scene between Shatner and George Takei, and this is one of the reasons why George Takei is so upset with Shatner, because he wanted that captaincy sooner than Star Trek VI.
Yeah.
And this scene was like one of the last scenes that they were going to film, but because it required Shatner to do 18 takes, and George Takei is a 1-2 take guy.
Yeah.
By the time he's on take 18, he's exhausted. He's spent. He's got nothing left.
Right.
So doing a 2-shot, you know, scene with the two of them, it was just impossible for Nick Meyer to pull that off in the time constraints he had.
Wow.
So that got put on the back burner until Nick Meyer comes back to writing, directing Star Trek VI. And it's like the full scene in the movie.
Yeah.
Captain Sulu.
It's interesting because I'm surprised to hear that it would have been included, because it's so unconnected to everything else in the plot.
I have no idea what the justification for that scene was within context. I'm sure Sulu would have had to have done more in the movie.
Yeah.
But because Sulu doesn't get the captaincy, I think things got left on the editing floor.
Oh, interesting. All right, so let's talk about the Reliant. This is our first shot at a new starship that the Starfleet has, other than the Enterprise class, the Constitution class. It's captained by a fantastic, wonderful actor who has a long sci-fi history, not only Star Trek, but other films as well. I can't believe I blanked his name. Captain Terrell is played by...
I'm looking it up. I went blank too.
He played... He plays in Darmok. In Darmok and Jurata Tanagra, he's the rival captain in that episode as well. Winfield.
Yes. Always. I can't remember if it was Paul or Peter.
Paul Winfield, a wonderful actor, and Chekhov is his first officer. So what's our thought about the Reliant and Captain Terrell and Chekhov and that whole starship?
I like the design, and it's clear that the producers of Star Trek like the design, because it's really, torpedo ball. It's compact. Like, I would like to have seen more sets outside of the bridge. Like, we don't get to see the bridge.
Okay.
We don't even know what the transporter room looks like. It's just the bridge. And for the purposes of this movie, that's fine.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, ship to ship. You don't need to see a lot of interiors with that.
Yeah, that's a cost issue, right? Because the bridge of the Reliant was just a repainted Enterprise bridge with some modifications.
And all the Reliant stuff is shot well before any of the Enterprise stuff is shot.
Oh.
So it's closer in design to what the original motion picture was.
Okay.
In terms of its layout and its little decals, because they saw it adding things to the Enterprise bridge, because they shot those scenes in a second.
Yep. I remember noting that it was small. It just looked like a smaller ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so from a game sense, this often became kind of a starter vessel. Like, if the PCs are like, you've got 4 or 5 players and they're not quite, you know, Enterprise level yet, then they start off on the Reliant class and they graduate to an Enterprise type ship later as a advancement, right? When their first ship blows up or they, you know, graduate to they all get promoted or whatever. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in Star Trek Online, that's exactly what you start off with, is a Reliant class starship. That's how you do the whole first 10 levels of the game, including the tutorial, are in a Reliant class starship, which makes no sense considering the game is set after Nemesis. So the ships would be ancient, but whatever.
It kind of has like a Wolkholz vibe to it. Like it's a small, like this is not, like I'm reminded of Relics when Scotty and Picard are talking about their false love. Like this is going to be someone's false love, but it's no one's pre-male prestige assignment.
right.
Okay, so the Reliant.
Yeah.
One of my favorite ships.
Is it?
Hands down. It is exactly the same thing. When I've played Star Trek Adventures, they get Reliant ship first of all.
Yeah,
Every time. It's just I just love the ship. I don't know what it is about it. I just think it's that saucer section with just a small back on it rather than everything looking like a Constitution class.
Yeah.
It's just a such a nice design. It's so good. And I had the model kit and everything. I love it. I absolutely love the damn ship. Yeah, yeah.
You have physical memory of the Reliant.
Like, oh, I love it. Yeah,
you built it, and so your body's like singing
again. It's them squaring the cells. Everything. Oh, it's just so good. Yeah, no, love it. And Tyrell as well is quite good as a captain. He gets a guest star mention on the credits. Along with Kirstie Alley, which is like, okay, because he is important to the plot. It's not just like, oh, you're Starseek Captain 754. You stand at the back and shout things. He actually is part of the plot. He gets to say stuff, he gets to do stuff. He sacrificed himself to stop killing Kirk. I mean, it's all very important stuff that goes on with Tyrell. So
there should be more Starfleet captains like Tyrell because he is not an idiot or a fascist.
Yeah, that's true.
Like he's a starship captain who's doing his job and he's pretty good at it, but you know he gets ambushed by Khan. That scene where Khan reveals himself for the first time and he's questioning Tyrell and Chekov is got to be one of my favorite scenes, maybe of all time. Like it's just the way that Montalban plays the character is so great. You've never told your captain this to amuse your captain. You know, like you would tell your captain the story about how your old buddy Kirk marooned a bunch of people on a planet for 15 years to die in a horrific accident as entertainment. You would do that. You do to pass the time.
The cool thing about that scene as well is number one. The little buggy thing in the sand
still looks
really good.
It does.
The little spores they put out of them, they still look as gross as anything, which is fantastic.
It's really kind of a horrifying scene.
Yeah.
That scene really scared me when they went into the ear.
Yeah. The ear, you can see the ear as a kind of like a prosthetic.
Yes,
but the bug's really good. But the spacesuit design is really nice. The whole thing is just so well put together, yeah.
So I've gone to a couple of these Star Trek exhibits.
Yes.
Like roaming museums.
Yes.
They'll have some props on display. And one of the props was Chekov's seal.
Oh, cool.
It's this giant prosthetic that's nail gunned to this wood board. And it's huge.
Yeah.
Like, you have no idea how big this thing. Like all I can see is a stretched out eel. I was standing there with my girlfriend at the time. And she's like, what the hell is that? I'm like, well, it's obviously Chekov's eel, but it's nightmare fuel is what this is.
Yeah. I guess that scene was bad enough that the UK, they had to cut it in the UK.
Yeah. Apparently there was three versions of it, I believe. There was like a standard version, like a gorier version and another version. But yeah, I believe that was one of them things, yeah.
So with Chekov, I kind of feel like we have the Peter principle.
Go ahead.
So the Peter principle is this idea that you continue to get promoted until you fail.
Yeah. Do you reach the level of your incompetence?
And I'm not saying this as any onus or being upset with, like, Chekhov is never going to be important to any of these movies except for Khan. And in the motion picture, he is taken off the bridge, he's wounded, and he comes back, and there was fanfare, like he relieves someone of a station.
Right.
In this film, he is mind-controlled. He's Hawkeye for much of the film.
Yes.
The only way the plot works is if he's Hawkeye.
Yeah.
He comes back, he's taken to sick bay, and then maybe 15 minutes later, he's miraculously on the bridge hitting the phaser button.
Actually, he fires the photon torpedo that blows up the Reliance.
He's destroying the ship that he is second officer. No hay is made about this.
That's true.
There was no scene for Chekhov to have where he is having to destroy his home. Like, that's essentially what he's doing in this moment in time. And it's not even mentioned. Like, I sort of feel like, I'm glad that all the actors get their paychecks. I'm glad to see Sulu, and I'm glad to see Uhura.
Yeah.
But outside of the big four of Spock, McCoy, and Scotty, they don't have much to do in terms of the plot.
That's very true, yeah.
And the one time Chekhov has, he doesn't even get a moment of acting. He's just a plot device.
Say they do mention the Reliance crew, which is nice.
Yeah.
Because when it's like, oh, we've got to go back to pick him up. It's like, okay, because some movies nowadays, we just go, oh, that's too much of a burden to put that line in there. Let's just ignore that. And they go, what happened to all the guys on Reliant? So we know that he did at least blow his own crew up when he blew the Reliant up. So that's something at least. But
it never occurred to me that Chekhov is firing on his own ship. And you're right. It would have been neat to acknowledge that. Even
having Chekhov come back to the bridge and welcomed in back into the family.
Right.
Like, even if it's just like a quick two-line scene between Sulu and him, or
that'd be cool.
Like, just some acknowledgement that, because we're watching the film and Chekhov is taken to the med bay, you know, to sick bay.
Yep.
And the film continues, and then suddenly Chekhov's giant face turns to camera, goes, you know, firing photon torpedoes. I'm like, where the fuck did you show up?
Well, he returns. He comes onto the bridge. Okay, the version I watched today, he walks on and asks to have his station back.
He does, yeah. In the standard version, he does, yeah.
And he sits. He goes back to his seat.
Right. The version I watched, I need to track down, because it did say in iTunes director's cut, but now I'm kind of questioning about a few things. So I think I'm going to have to track down and figure out what cut this is.
Interesting.
Because it may have been like the cut for the TV and they just called it.
Oh, maybe.
Interesting.
Because that scene with Chekhov did not happen. It was so jarring. I told Misty, I'm like, I have memory of him showing up on the bridge.
Yeah.
And the funny thing, also thinking about the size of Reliant being smaller. Now, I remember thinking this when I was watching it, is that the fact that I think there's 77 of Khan's men off of the planet. I think they say there were 77. I don't know if 77 actually survived or 77 were placed there originally. Okay. But they all managed to fly the Reliant. So it's obviously got to be a fairly small crew. Because every time the Reliant gets hit by something, there's always a Khanite being blown up as well.
Yeah.
So it's like, we hit the nacelle. There's just happened to be some guy up there. Oh, the sensor pod at the top's been gone. Oh, there's a guy out there as well. So they've obviously got to be a small ship.
But by the end, Khan is the only person alive on the bridge.
Seems to be, yeah.
So he's basically flying it by himself.
Yep.
All right, so I remember hearing a lot of stories when this film was released, that they had kept the death of Spock very secret, and that I had heard, and this is probably not true, multiple endings for the movie in which Spock didn't die. Considering how expensive it is to film scenes that you don't use, I'm sure that's false. But how did Spock's death become part of this film? What's that story, and what were the ramifications of that?
So with any of these Star Trek movies, especially these six, it's always going to be the last Star Trek movie.
Oh, really?
They always go into it with the idea of, like, this movie is supposed to be the last one in the series, so what are we going to do to send off this crew?
Well, that explains the Sulu. That explains the Captain Sulu thing then.
So those things were like, okay, maybe we can introduce ideas, but the main cast is getting too expensive. So every time they do one of these things, they always have to rebuild the bridge, which adds to the cost. Like, none of the bridges are going to be consistent.
Like, you could easily imagine a Captain Sulu with Savick and Marcus, right, as the supporting cast, traveling the stars on the Excelsior as a spinoff show or whatever.
Yeah. And then you're only paying for the returning cast members that you decide to have there, and Shatner and Nimoy are your biggest expense,
right?
Because of the Favored Nations clause, they get the exact same amount of money,
right?
Regardless of how much screen time they get. Okay. So every single time it's approached like, this is going to be the last film, and Nimoy didn't want to do this film.
Okay.
And Nick Miles came in and was like, well, what if we give you a death scene? What if we give you a Shakespearean death?
Yeah.
Sequence? So he writes the script and Nimoy reads it and he likes it. And he's like, I really enjoy this. And Miles keeps adding pages at the beginning of the script.
Okay.
He'll add four more pages. So the death scene happens not at the end of act one, it happens in the middle of act two. And then right. Nimoy's like, I really enjoy this. And then he'll add a couple more pages.
Yeah.
So that's how you get Nimoy for the whole picture. So the director's just adding pages into it. And it's like, okay. And he's sort of like just padding it out. So that's sort of like how the structure happens. Now, only seven people knew that Spock was going to die.
Okay.
Shatner knew, Nimoy knew, Miles knew, Hall Bennett, the executive producer, who will regret having that title later. Katzenberg and Michael Eisner and Gene Roddenberry. So those were the seven people who knew.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden, at one of these fan conventions, news breaks out that Spock is going to die in the next movie. And that starts a letter writing campaign.
Wow.
And that's the reason why Spock dies twice in this film. That's the whole reason the Kobayashi Maru comes into play.
Was to fake out the fans.
Fake out the fans and the letter writing campaign.
You know, I
thought those seven people, the only one who would have an agenda to do that would be Roddenberry.
That worked on me. Like when I was, because I went to the movie and I saw Spock die in the first 10 minutes and I was like, oh, okay, everybody dies. Okay. Yeah, that worked.
Yeah. So that's sort of like, that was the big thing that happened with this film is they're like, all right, we'll just create a testing simulator sequence. They reuse the special effects from the motion picture in terms of the Klingons.
Yep.
So that's completely just lifted from that film. And you have the scene that cements all of the themes that I've been talking about of the movie in the very first sequence, which is just a feint to be like, hey, fans, we're going to fake you out so that you can calm down and watch the movie. And then when Spock dies at the end, you're like, oh, my God, Spock's really dead at the end.
You said that Roddenberry was the only person with a motivation. What was that motivation?
Well, he had lost control of the franchise.
Oh.
So he was one of the narratives that come out, whether it's correct or not, is that the motion picture cost so much money because Roddenberry was a pain in the ass.
Right. Right.
Because he was doing that script nonsense where he was writing in pages and he was rewriting Harold Livingston. So when Hall Bennett was hired, Hall Bennett just essentially said, "You're an executive producer. You get." You know, we're giving you this, we're giving you knowledge as to the movie in terms of out of respect for what you did, but we're not taking any of your contributions. Like originally Roddenberry wants to do Klingons, use the Guardians of Forever to go back in time and kill JFK. And the ending of that movie is Spock on the grassy knoll correcting the timeline.
Holy shit.
Yeah, the idea it was the Klingons trying to save JFK so to create an alternate timeline. It's like you're telling me that Star Trek people have got to kill JFK? That just seems what the hell's idea thought that was a great idea. Yeah, it's just like that's just nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank God we never saw that. I mean, I can only imagine because Kirk is such the embodiment of like the JFK ideal, especially in the original series.
Yeah.
To literally kill off the person that you're aping, like it just seems weird to me.
Yeah, Yeah, I don't think that Spock as Lee Harvey Oswald would have been a big hit.
No. And this script comes back again when Star Trek IV comes around, and they're like, okay, we're going to do time travel.
Okay.
But Eddie Murphy stops that one. That's a story for a couple of weeks.
That's a story for another time.
And again, just before you go, cool thing about the Kobayashi Maru thing as well is it has Klingons in it, so it keeps Klingons in people's memories without actually having them involved with the movie. So, okay, they're instantly recognizable. It's K-7 battleships. Okay, that's, yeah. It's. I think that's right. That scene is really clever because it's just like, yeah, there's Klingons. They're still there.
No, so. Kobayashi Maru has had a tremendous footprint in Star Trek lore. Totally. Like, everybody knows the name of it. Like, and it comes up in later films and everyone, you know, there's a whole novel named after it and everyone has to figure out what your solution to the Kobayashi Maru would be.
Should we come up with solutions? Like, what's your solution, Jason?
Okay, no, I saw your Twitter solution, so I want you to tell it first.
Okay, my Twitter solution was I'm going to do kind of a I'll have the Enterprise parked on the neutral zone.
Okay.
To draw all the attention. Okay. And then I would lead a shuttle mission, like an armada of shuttles, and try to sneak into the Klingon space and rescue the crew and ignore the ship.
Okay, so
the idea is you have to save the ship. I'm not saving the ship. I'm saving the people.
You realize, of course, that you must fail.
Oh yeah.
So your shuttles will arrive, but as I just listened to it, so they're losing their life support. So by the time your shuttles arrive, because what you're describing takes a hell of a lot longer than it takes Savick to get there on the Enterprise, by the time your shuttles arrive, everybody's dead. That's the answer. That's what happens in your version.
Well, I'm that's the version I have at the moment. but my thing is, like, I've always, like, this test always makes more sense to me if it's next generation time.
Okay.
Because if it's in the holodeck, it can naturally adapt to it. Like, this simulator is only confined by the span of a room. But if it's on the holodeck, it can always continually evolve to adapt to whatever solution you come up to it.
But the point of it is that no matter what solution you come up with, you must fail. That's the real test.
Like, I understand that, but my thinking of it is... Yeah. Like, within the confines of like, because we see, like, the bridge opening up.
Yeah.
Like, all you have is bridge control.
Right. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It makes more sense if it's a holodeck when you have the whole ship that you can run into.
Yes. I'm sure there's a Kobayashi Maru part two, like, 2.0. That they.
Anyway, Abe, what's your solution? Since Jason just hailed up.
I honestly can't think of anything good. the only thing I was thinking as well is when I remember watching this the first time around, and I remember the mention of the neutral zone.
Yeah.
And obviously my mind immediately goes to Romulan neutral zone, and I was trying to figure out why the hell are the Klingons in the Romulan neutral zone? And it's Klingon neutral zone. Yeah. And now, because, and I don't know how many times is that referenced in the original series, the actual Klingon neutral zone, because then you've got like the Organian treaty, which is which kind of gets blown off, and then kind of a 14-day war or something, and then between the Federation and the Klingons.
Yeah.
And it gets resorted out. But I don't really remember actually kind of like references to a neutral zone set up between Federation and Klingon space.
Maybe this is the film that invented
it. That's what I think it might be. And it's, and I it's all these little, again, because I did stuff for the RPG and I was doing lots of stuff that mostly kind of, it was always kind of like in character stuff referencing events.
Yeah.
And so I was picking through all the encyclopedia stuff and finding out all this neutral zone stuff and all these things. It's like, it's nice to see where those little pieces of information actually come from, kind of like firsthand as such.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. But yeah, as for the Kobayashi Maru, I don't know. I'd just probably just shoot in there and see if we can get them to crash into each other or something.
The truth of the matter is that Savick does everything right.
Yeah.
She does exactly what you're supposed to do. And and she fails anyway, because that's the point of the test.
Mm.
Right? And Kirk tells her that, but later in the film acknowledges he doesn't actually believe in it. Like he tells her how we face death is important as facing as how I face life. Sometimes there's a no-win scenario, but he acknowledges that he actually never believed in it. So he's just sort of doing what his job requires him to do with that scene. And I don't know. I
that sums Kirk up pretty well, though.
Yeah, it does.
Even for the original series, it's like, well, yeah. Okay, I'm going to do something that's completely unorthodox, but I'm not going to give up.
I trick death, and I pat myself on the back for it.
No, I love that line. Yeah, that is so good.
Yeah, it's such a well-written film. All right, so...
To A's point, I'm doing some quick memory alpha here. And this is actually the first time Klingon Neutral Zone is used.
Oh, there you go.
Mainly to justify the fact that they wanted to use the Klingons. They wanted to have that, like it's setting up the prime directive rule, right? They wanted to have a rule that the character breaks.
Yeah.
So that's where they came up with Klingon Neutral Zone.
All right, so let's talk about Spacey. Before this film, if someone had told me that Kirk's nemesis, his great arch enemy, was Khan from a one episode of the original series, I would not have remembered who this guy is. Like, I haven't even seen the episode that many times. But this film made Khan into Kirk's forever nemesis. Why Space Seed? Why Khan? Why Montalban? What's the story behind this?
So Hal Bennett watched every episode of the original series.
Okay.
He wanted to have, like, before he took the job and he's like, I don't really like Star Trek. I've never liked it. I know it's, my wife likes it. It's the show with the guy with the eels, right?
Okay.
So he's a producer and he sits down and he watches every single episode over the span of a week or two. Like, he has it filmed for him on the Paramount lot.
He binges it.
This is like one of the full showings of like binging TV.
Okay.
And he watches every single episode and he's like, all right, I need to find someone from the show to bring in. Because Hal Bennett is the one who introduces Khan in the various drafts.
We need a villain.
Hal Bennett's idea. So he wants a villain. He wants a heavy.
Which is kind of what Star Trek 1 missed, really, at the end of the day.
I mean, V'ger is an antagonist, but it's more confused than evil.
Yeah.
And it's also disembodied. Like, we don't really have a face for it other than Ilea, and she's too busy being sexy robot.
Yeah.
So he's sort of like, he sits down and he watches it, and he takes, like, Nick Miles, I think, sits down and watches 30 episodes. Like, he gives, like, Hal Bennett goes up to him and is like, here's the 30 episodes you should watch.
Oh, okay.
So Nick Miles sits down and Space Seed's in there.
And
I don't think they entertain the idea of any other antagonist coming over.
Interesting.
And maybe it's because, like, Ricardo Montalban was available.
Well, and he's riding high on Fantasy Island.
Yeah.
That 6 seasons of Fantasy Island
was a
bedrock. And I remember that show because as a kid, I wasn't allowed to watch it. It was on from 9 to 10, right? Because it was supposed to be a little bit scarier and a little bit more adult. And so so my bedtime was 9 o'clock, right? And so I was kind of fascinated with the show because it was a show I was not allowed to watch.
Yeah. And even like the first few days of filming, because like I said, like Ricardo Montalban shot first. He's shot first because he's still filming Fantasy Island.
Okay.
And at one point, Nick Mayo has to pull him aside and be like, "Dude, you're doing Michael Wolk. You're not doing Khan."
Yeah.
And he was like, "Oh my God, I'm not doing Khan." He came in, and the next day he's like, he goes way over the top.
Okay.
And then Nick Mayo has to pull him aside again. And goes, "Okay, here's some words from Laurence Olivier." Which is never let them see your top.
Wow.
So I need you to be big, but I don't ever want to see that energy that you had yesterday, because once you show them your top, everything else is downhill. And so like Ricardo Montalban takes this advice and then he keeps it like that growling symbol like through the whole movie.
And I also read that he went back and he watched Space Seed, watched his own younger self. To help him recapture the character.
And Space Seed's a good episode. Like, it's a, well, I just watched it. I did the Tron marathon.
Yes.
Yesterday.
Space Seed, Star Trek II, and?
Into Darkness.
I'm so sorry, Jim.
I should have stopped while I was ahead. I was like, maybe this movie isn't as bad as I remember. It's worse. But that'll get its podcast. Watching Space Seed, there is an interesting element of sexuality in the episode.
Go ahead.
Like, there was a dominant submission thing going on between Khan and his soon-to-be wife, MacGyver.
That's exactly what I was going to say. The entire episode is just like, you will submit to me. Yes, it's such a weird episode, yeah.
And outside of the context of an S&M relationship, it's weird. Like, as a child, I never quite caught into the episode because of that. Like, there was that weird element of that I didn't understand. But now as an adult, I'm like, oh, okay, this is what they're doing.
Okay, yeah.
In a show aimed to children sometimes.
Well, this is Roddenberry horny on Maine again, right? Like, I'm inclined to place the S&M aspects of Space Seed on Roddenberry's doorstep.
But this is a trip by episode.
Go ahead, Ed.
I was going to say, this was what always bugged me about the episode, is that that everyone on board the Enterprise apparently is a Starfleet officer, okay? So they've been picked, they're supposed to be, you know, competent, She's willing to give it up because some bloke turns up in a spaceship. And it just seems like she crumbles so quickly to discard all of her thing. Oh, Khan, yeah, I'll do everything for you. Oh, Khan, yeah, I'll just destroy all my friends. It just seems, I hate when that happens.
Yeah.
When it's almost like the guest star, the guest alien pops up and everyone just completely forgets everything they've ever had with any other character.
The other thing is it's done so quickly is so that she can have a double talk, right? Like, so she betrays Khan at the end of the episode.
Yeah. You
know, by saving Kulk's life.
Yeah.
So it's they have to rush to the initial tone.
Yeah.
And under Khan's control. And then when she's like, oh shit, he means this, I'm going to go save the captain for no reason. Like, they don't explain it at all.
Yeah.
And she's just like, I'm going to be the one who can do it.
And that actress was originally cast in Wrath of Khan, but tragically, she had serious health problems and was confined to a wheelchair.
Oh, really? I didn't know about that.
The actress whose name I do not recall, because I presume that Jim knows everything, so he would know her. She was originally in the script as returning. And she was going to play Khan's wife, the same character from the original episode. But she had, I believe, muscular dystrophy. And she was confined to a wheelchair. And so when Bennett found out, he instead made the character having died. And
Which I was sort of curious as well, because they never acknowledged the character by name. And it would have been nice to acknowledge the character by name, because Chekhov obviously knew her. So that would at least be something.
Yeah,
You killed my wife, you killed da-da-da, and Chekhov could have gone, oh crap, I knew her on the Enterprise. That would have been something as well for Chekhov to react to. So,
my wife just corrected me. It actually is explained by Khan why MacGyver betrays him. Because she can't stand she's not strong enough to watch the torture of people she knows. As opposed to, like, if everyone died on the bridge, that's one thing, but watching it is a different thing. And that's why she has the double tone.
Can't stomach it, huh?
Yeah. My overriding thesis for Wrath of Khan is it's the Watchmen of the Star Trek franchise.
Okay, what does that mean? Okay. It's got a giant evil alien squid in it.
It's squid in it, yeah.
It elevates... So Watchmen, within the context of superhero narratives, it elevates the superhero narrative to becoming an adult genre, right? It's no longer Superman gets random power because he's exposed to kryptonite rock. It's now we're dealing with impotency. We're dealing with nuclear destruction. We're dealing with the Superman character as a symbol of American superpower, right? So it takes it, and it's so well constructed and so on point in terms of his themes. And yeah, we can quibble here and there about the ending and whatnot. But for the most part, it's a solid piece of seminal comic book work. Like, if you're going to read superhero comics at some point, you have to read Watchmen. Okay. That's just part of the course. If you're going to have any interest in Star Trek whatsoever, you're going to have to watch Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
Even if you don't like the original series, like, it's just one of those things where it's, like you said, Kobayashi Maru is so baked into all society, not just like Star Trek, but like, I can make a Kobayashi Maru reference in another TV show, and everyone knows what I'm talking about. So it's this watershed moment where it takes the rinky-dink TV show, and I say that with love, and the lackluster motion picture, and it elevates it to a new form. My problem with it is not so much the movie itself, but it's the legacy of the movie.
Okay.
Well, like Watchmen, which spawned a bunch of imitators of various qualities.
Yeah, largely pretty bad.
On within the Star Trek film franchise has spawned a bunch of copycats.
Oh, okay. Copycon.
And I think each of the copycats are less than the original, and by extension, it sort of takes some of the bloom off, you know, the rose off the bloom, right? And that's sort of my overall thesis when it comes to Wrath of Khan. Like, it's the Watchmen. It is required reading if you are going to call yourself a Trek fan at some point or another. But because it's repeatedly taken and referenced and homaged and ripped off, the only film I feel that successfully does it is False Contact, because in False Contact, it's our hero who has the quest for vengeance, scenery chewing scene and is out to get the Borg at whatever the cost is, and someone quotes Moby Dick to him, and then he snaps out of it. Because now he recognizes Moby Dick is cautionary tale, whereas Khan looks at Moby Dick as instruction manual.
Star Trek VI is famous for its Shakespeare quotes. It very much feels like a riff on Khan's Moby Dick quotes.
And like, and it's not even like, even after you get out of the six movies, like Nemesis, the whole third act of Nemesis is straight up Wrath of Khan. Like, you can just stop that movie when they go into the nebula and just put on the nebula scene from Wrath of Khan and have a better movie. Even including the point where Data programs his mind inside B4 and then sacrifices his life. And then that doesn't even begin Star Trek Into Darkness, which is just such a dumpster fire.
Well, I remember reading one of your essays that you wrote about Into Darkness and about the resurrection of Khan in that film. So I'm really eager to talk about that. But we probably should not jump too far ahead, considering we're already at an hour, and we still got plenty of Khan to talk about. But this film also introduced a couple of other really important supporting characters, like Carol Marcus, and Savick, and David, who all become very big elements of this Star Trek pantheon. Some more than others. Who should we start with?
So let's start with Carol.
Okay.
Of all the characters in this movie, I think Carol is the most interesting.
Yeah, she is really interesting.
She doesn't get a lot of screen time.
Do we presume that she had a relationship with Kirk sometime, like when? Because David is not a kid.
David's a doctor. David is a doctor in his own right. He's referred to as Dr. Marcus.
Yeah, he says, I'm Dr. Marcus. Yeah.
So he has to at least be 35, like, or at least 30. Let's say he's really small. Maybe he got his doctorate degree only maybe by 27. So maybe he's a 27, 30-year-old.
Yeah.
That means Kirk must have met her, like, straight out of the academy.
Yeah.
This is, like, a young romance. This is before, you know, Kirk has become Kirk. Like, this is maybe he's a lieutenant somewhere.
He left her to join Starfleet, right?
Yeah. And one of the interesting things about Carol Malkus is she is a character that shows up in all the novelizations from this point onward.
Yeah.
Even though she's in none of the movies. And the reason for that is J.M. Dillon is the writer of those novelizations, and she was like, I'm using Carol Malkus. So Carol shows up in all of those novelizations in some way, shape, or form.
That's interesting.
And she winds up having more resonance because of it.
But the actress never returns.
The actress never returns. The character's never actually mentioned.
Yeah.
Like, David is mentioned, but David doesn't talk about his mom, and Colt doesn't talk about Carol.
Yeah,
David, which is such a missed opportunity.
David is the obscure scientist who lives one extra movie because he is Kirk's son.
Yeah.
But again, that is well done, because yeah, most of the time, those guest stars never show up again. It's like, oh, you had a son last movie. Yeah, he went away. Just acknowledge that fact, which is really good.
Yeah.
I wish, like, and that's one of the things that I'm sorry, I'm going to have to do it, Jason. The things that upset me about Into Darkness is they have a Carol Malkus there.
Yes.
And she is wasted.
She's totally.
And you're doing young Colt and young Carol. Like, you can actually do something that the movies never gave us. Yeah. You can show us their first meeting. You can show us how they interact. You can show us a woman that Colt would consider leaving the Starfleet for.
Yeah.
And the movie does nothing with it. Because the movie has a serious case of why is a Skywalker. Which is, anytime there's a moment to think about something, we interrupt it with a gunfight.
Yeah, yeah. People often forget that when Dashiell Hammett said, have some guy bust down the door with a gun, that was a cautionary tale. He was saying, don't do that. He was actually, if you read that line in context, he's using that as an example of what bad writers do.
Yeah.
And J.J. Abrams.
And that's all over the remake of Khan.
Okay, I'm just going on to Memory Alpha. And according to this, there's a thing in Star Trek chronology that says that it may be 2261 when Carol Malkus gave birth to David, and it's 2284 when the Genesis Project is. So he's got to be like in his early to mid-20s.
Yeah, but that still puts it before the five-year mission. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Although it does name him it says on here as a Starfleet officer. It doesn't say anything about captain or a lieutenant or anything. So yeah, previous to the 5 year mission. Yeah. And again, it may have been me cross mixing the Kelvin universe stuff, but I was always under the assumption that she served aboard the Enterprise at some point as well. But that might just be because obviously the Kelvin version served aboard the Enterprise.
The autobiography of James C. Colt, which is not in canon,
oh, yes,
actually makes a lot of hay about the fact that Carol tells Colt to go away.
Right.
And so the entire five-year mission, every romantic encounter is also filtered through this Carol Malkus, David Malkus lens.
So it's like
a retroactive continuity. And it's sort of wonderfully done in terms of like explaining like Colt's psychosis.
So that's pretty cool, because they did the same thing with James Bond, Tracy Bond died.
Yeah.
And it was always like, well, this is the reason why you're such a womanizer, because you had the woman you found, she died, and everybody else after that never lived up to her. That's why you just carried on going.
Yeah.
And it's that's a really cool story point, yeah.
So Carol's great, and although I David has also kind of grown on me over the years.
David.
He doesn't really you hate David?
I just, the sweater, like him walking around in the sweater, just, it's so 80s. Like, just take the tennis racket and go down to the rec hall.
Yes.
Like, he's like the most, like, anytime you watch a movie, you can kind of, within a couple years, place where it was based on the fashion and the hairstyles and what the techniques are. David is the one thing that dates this movie more than anything else.
He does. You're right.
The platinum blonde hair that's in the Colling fashion to the sweaters he's wearing. Like, it dates the movie so much for me.
It does. You're right. I mean, you're not wrong about that. He doesn't have much of a part, but I thought that he executed the lines that he had pretty well. The scene when he talks to Kirk at the end and reveals to Kirk that his mother has told him who his father is.
The irony being is that David is large. Sorry, Jason. He's not even really needed in the plot. If it was just a past relationship with Kirk, it would have worked. Yeah. David's not a key point to it at all, but he's there. And obviously, for Star Trek 3, he's obviously much more important.
Yes,
but it's a strange addition because it's like, oh, this he's there, and he's like, okay, man.
I think he's there because it ties into Kirk feeling old.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's all part of his age issue, right? Yeah. And it also, David becomes the contrast character for Kirk because there's that really key moment where there's the moment in the film when the film is trying to tell you what it's about. And the scene in this film is, there's a couple of them, but they're always between Carol and Kirk. And Carol is talking to Kirk when they're inside the Genesis planet, the asteroid.
Phase 2.
Yeah, Phase 2, right. And she says, who is this guy? You know, and she's talking about Khan. And Kirk says, you know, I'm this guy who wants to kill me for something that I did to him 15 years ago. And I just met my son who wants to help him do it. That's why David's in this picture, is because David represents the Kirk's failings. And he has this image of Kirk as a militant, you know, tool of the man.
Yeah.
And Kirk has to convince him that that's not what Kirk really is. He has to win over his son. And he does that. And that's all part of Kirk's growth process over this film. He has to acknowledge his past mistakes. And we don't know what happened between him and Carol, but whatever happened, I think it's fair to say that Kirk fucked up. Right? Like, I think we can safely say that whatever happened, it was his fault.
But again, only watching this recently as well you realize that the Doctor team that they're working for technically is still part of the Federation, but they're not part of Starfleet. Right. Back then, it was just like, hey, they're the good guys. Why they're arguing between themselves? They should have, we're the good guys. So we're seeing like a wider Federation now that's not just Starfleet.
Yeah. And there's that great line from Carol where she says, look, the Starfleet has maintained peace for 100 years. I cannot and will not ascribe to your interpretation of events, right?
Which that line is totally contradicted by Star Trek Discovery.
It is.
Like, that line is just... We chucked that out the other long. The thing that the one of the nice things about, so Carol gets no reference, like she doesn't exist in the original TV show. Right. But there was a line that Gary Mitchell has in the second pilot, Where No Man Has Gone Before.
Yep.
Where he tells Colt that he's the one who sent that little blonde his way. And Colt says, I almost married her. That was you?
Really?
And so the sort of assumed continuity has been, after this movie came out, is Carol's blonde, so therefore Carol's the blonde that Gary Mitchell is talking about.
Wow. Okay.
It's just a throwaway line, this little bit of banter between Gary Mitchell and Jim Conk, and it's sort of right into that this is who that character is supposed to be.
Yeah. Okay, how about Savick? Introducing Kirstie Alley. Right.
I figured this is when the A and I can take a break and you'll just talk about
how much you're now. Well, I was the right age, okay? Like I was a very impressionable 14-year-old when this movie came out. And you know, Kirstie Alley was beautiful and I loved the character. But in many ways, I think the tragedy of Savick is that not so much that she was recast, because the second actress did a fine job with the character, but that the character as a whole ended up being abandoned over the course of the 6-movie series. And we'll talk more about this later when we get to 6. But I loved the introduction of Savick as a protagonist character. I mean, she's the captain of the Enterprise when the lights come up, right? And we soon find out that she's, you know, a cadet or whatever, and she's not actually the captain, Lieutenant Savick. But if you're looking for a way to bring new people into Star Trek, casting a new face in the center chair, surrounded by all the old people that we recognize, is a great way to do that. And so she's really the reader identification character of this movie. And she even asks crazy questions like, you know, what's the deal with Kirk? And you know, why is he like that? And so I think that as a new face, she has a great job on the Enterprise. And I just wish that she had been able to continue into later pictures with the same well-written role that she had in this one.
See, I like Savick, and the reason I like Savick in this is, even though she's Vulcan, she doesn't have that kind of standoffishness that other Vulcans have ever been. I mean, like T'Pol in Enterprise, she took her 2 seasons to before she got kind of relaxed with the crew. Is it, you know, she was literally just blank slate. I show no emotion. Savick, this one seems to at least acknowledge she can learn things. She can understand things rather than just being that's illogical that you expect from everything else. I think she's great. And like you say, it's a shame that we didn't get more of her at some point. But
there's a famous apocryphal story, which I understand got written into the novels and was cut from the film, where we learn about Savick's past, that she's actually half Romulan. And that she grew up on in a Vulcan colony that was destroyed by Romulans or something. I forget what all the story goes. But
you've got the major point.
That's the gist of it. Mm-hmm. This helped to explain why she wears her hair down, because when you only have a few scenes, everything that physically that you do is a metaphor for your character, right? So you're absolutely right, Age. She is she's more relaxed and less formal. And we see that in her personality and also in her physically, right? So there's that terrible, which she finds Kirk in the elevator and he tries not to hit on her. It's kind of creepy. I think she's wonderful, and it would have been, she was kind of obviously the sort of heir apparent character. This fits in a lot with what Jim was telling me. I didn't know that this film was originally written to be the end of the Star Trek series of films. But now that you mentioned that and we have this idea of a Sulu taking over a new ship afterwards, it's very easy to imagine Savick become sort of filling in for the Spock role, right? In fact, I can't believe I didn't think of this. Like, it's Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, right? Except that instead of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, you've got Sulu, Savick, and David. Even down to the medical officer and the Vulcan science officer, right? Like, it's kind of classic.
And the cool thing also Savick gets as well is, first of all, she gets to actually do stuff in the film. Okay? Yeah. Like you say, she's the first person you see literally commanding Enterprise on the first scene.
Yeah.
Throughout the film, she actually does stuff, which is nice.
She's right.
She doesn't die because she's the new guy in the Enterprise, which is really good as well. Because every other time, like we said before, this is Lieutenant Hawk, this is Decker. It's like, your time's numbered. Just stick around.
Yeah, Lieutenant Hawk was the worst of it.
Yeah,
yeah. So I like Sam. So the reason I'm ribbing Jason, is I ran a Star Trek game, and I was gonna set it in between TOS movie era and Next Generation, and it was going to deal with the yesterday Enterprise C incident. From, like, we get this distress call from Tasha Yar, and she becomes sort of like the face of it. But the captain I gave them was Savick.
Yeah,
I mean, Jason just, like, I gave him a Christmas present.
It was pretty great.
and then I sat there and I was like, why is he so happy about it? like I like Savick, but Savick's not. And then I did the math. I was like, oh, he was 14.
Yeah.
I got those.
And the immortal words of Ensign Tilly, behold the power of math, people.
Yeah. Because he was so, like, enthusiastic about it. I'm like, wow, I'm so glad I came up with this idea.
Yeah. The new costume, of course, every movie we get new costumes. These remain one of my favorite Trek uniforms, even though they're so different from everything else. Like, they don't have the three different color jackets, you know, they're all different than what the normal Trek uniforms are like. But God, I love those uniforms. I think it's
definitely some of the best uniforms I made.
It's the sides bit, right? Yep. Like the flap.
Yeah. And again, it sticks through pretty much unchanged through to Star Trek VI. So obviously they knew they had a good thing.
Yeah.
I cannot imagine Rafa Khan being in them crappy gray and tan uniforms. It would have just been awful.
The stupidest thing they ever did with uniforms was put Wesley Crusher's dad in the same red uniform, except take away the turtleneck. And it looks so dumb.
So I can speak from personal experience that these uniforms are not comfortable.
I believe it.
they overheat.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think they ever look quite as good as they do in Wrath of Khan.
Okay, yeah.
I think the lighting and the atmosphere of the film, making it a submarine movie, enemy below kind of approach to how those action scenes are shot, I don't think the uniforms ever quite look as good. Like Star Trek VI, I think, comes close to that. But Star Trek VI, they kind of have this weird effect of overexposing the lens with too much light.
Oh, really?
So it sort of winds up bleeding out. Like, I'm thinking of the scene where they're in the Starfleet CNC, and everyone's wearing the maroon jacket. And I'm just like, I don't know. I just think the lighting in this one solves the movie so much better than anything else that they do after this.
Interesting. We'll have to get back to
that. So the design has an element of functionality about it. It feels like especially when they go down to the Genesis it feels like they've actually put those coats on because they have a use rather than just like, oh, costume change. Kirk was always changing costumes in the classic series from the gold thing, the green thing, the one he's got. This actually has a purpose, and it's just they're really nice. And I don't know if you're going to same as the engineers' uniforms, which I mentioned in Star Trek 1, these are great in this as well. They seem to have a function. There's the emergency, the idea they've got the oxygen on them. It's just well thought out. Someone's done a really good job with these uniforms.
It's the most maritime looking costume because they got the turtleneck. Like, you can see that turtleneck in an Ahab movie.
Yeah,
like, you just put it on, and they've got vests. It looks great. They're not comfortable.
Did you have to wear? When did you wear one?
My mom is a seamstress. She's made throughout my life. She's made various Star Trek costumes. And when Wrath of Khan came out, they got my dad got the original whatever it is. And they're not called blueprints, but I guess it was pattern.
Yeah, yeah.
I know my wife is shouting at the other room. She got the initial pattern for it and the initial fabric cost, and she stitched up the uniform for my dad. Well, my dad became more Scotty than Captain Kirk. One time when I went to one of these exhibits in Pasadena on the Star Trek tour, when I was in high school, I dressed up in the full regalia. That's and it's Admiral Kirk's uniform. It's got the gold stripe.
Yes.
Did it have the bloody handprint on it?
So hot. Like, you have to open it up. Like, I'm watching, I'm watching the performance. I'm like, man, William Shatner is the luckiest son of a bitch on this show because he gets to have it open.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to find it, but there is a photograph of me at my parents' house somewhere while I'm wrestling with a Klingon who's in the full, movie era Klingon regalia at this convention. This sort of Pasadena tour. I need to find it.
That's fantastic. Any final thoughts on the film?
Okay, one thing I've got to mention, because we did mention it last time as well, is music.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so I completely forgot when we watched Star Trek 1 that it's the Next Generation theme. It's like, oh my God, it's Next Generation. Oh, this is so good, right?
Yeah.
So we get it at the beginning, we get it at the end. It's like, oh, okay, this feels like Star Trek now. Even though even though the two themes at the end and the bit in the middle, but the two themes at the end, that's really good.
Yes.
So as we were saying, we're going to do this next time. I go onto Google last Sunday and go through the thing, and they're talking about the. I'm waiting for the Blu-rays to arrive. So they say that when they wanted to do the music, they wanted something more modern that wasn't the old Star Trek stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, oh, crap, okay, this is going to be terrible. Is it going to be 80s synth rock stuff or whatever? And as soon as the music came off Star Trek Wrath of Khan, oh my god, I remember how good this music is.
Yeah.
This music is so damn good. It is absolutely amazing. And it's all the way through. I'm just waiting for those kind of bits that's like, okay, where's the bit that kind of, this is 1982. There's none of that in there. It's all orchestral. It's so good.
The battle music, like when Khan, you know, when the Reliant is closing or whatever, we see the Khan and does that, like that, you know, it's so great. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It's so great that James Horner reuses it for Aliens.
Really?
Yes. Right. So James Horner is the one who composes this music. And I've seen a lot of movies that he's done. Commando.
Yeah.
He's done Field of Dreams.
Of course,
he's done Alien. Like, he's all over the place, right?
Yeah.
So that that little bit of music that you just quoted is actually in the Alien scene right before Billy Paxton and What's-Her-Face die.
I remember it.
It's when they're in the corridor and the aliens are coming up from the ground and they're like, we're going to die. It's the same couple measures.
This is when
I have a feeling that Cook should be running down a hallway at this point.
This is when Hudson is saying, oh, you want some? You want some too?
Yeah.
Like, yeah,
and that's when the music cue kicks in. I'm like, you know what? You just plagiarized yourself, but okay.
It's also when Vasquez and Gorman are crawling through the tunnel, through the ventilation shaft. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
It's weird. It feels so Horatio Hornblower. It's got that epic kind of swashbuckly kindness to it.
Yeah.
And it's just so good. Amazing.
Thank you, everybody, for watching, for listening to our show. We will be back with Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, next week.
And there's only one cut.
What's that?
There's only one cut.
Is there only one?
Yeah. From this point on, well, there's no concept of a director's cut. We don't have to deal with any of that. Who's watching what version of the film?
And anything that we should be looking for before we watch it, before we all review it?
Well, I think the thing that we have to sort of keep in mind is, like, retroactively, ex post facto, this is sort of part of the second part of a trilogy.
Yeah.
Like the Spock Resurrection trilogy.
Yes.
Is what this is sort of like looked at. Like when you remove it, when you see like Star Trek the movie trilogy, it's 2 through 4.
Yeah.
They even released it as a Blu-ray a couple years ago as such. So I think we have to kind of look at this as a second act, the second movement of three-part story.
Interesting. Okay, good. Abe, what are your thoughts? What are your recollections of Star Trek III?
I remember it being pretty slow. but we do get to see some really cool movie Klingons in it, so that's always good.
Yeah, you know, I remember Christopher Lloyd being the Klingon, and I was still thinking of him as Doc Brown
from
the Back to the Future films. And he was kind of coming off of that as far as his fame and reputation as a character actor. And I knew that... So I have one last question for Jim. As I'm watching the end of Star Trek II, they clearly hint that Spock is coming back to life, right? Like they say, you know, Kirk says in his kind of closing monologue, but on a planet named Genesis, who knows what the
future
brings? And I'll have to come back here one day.
All right, so this is where Nick Miles and Hal Bennett fight.
Okay.
So Nick Miles is not interested in the resurrection story. He has no involvement in Star Trek III.
Okay.
He shows up in Star Trek IV because he doesn't mind working on the character of Spock.
Right.
But he does all the sequences that take place in the past. He has no problem doing it after a resurrection, but he's not interested in Spock, you know, Jesus Christ metaphor.
Yeah.
So Hal Bennett, Leonard Nimoy goes to Hal Bennett in Star Trek II, and they're like, I'm really enjoying myself. If we do another one, is there any way I can come back? And Bennett's like, I don't know. What do you have in mind? I said, well, we have this mind meld, and we'll do this remember thing.
Yes.
I don't know what it means. I don't know what we can do with it, but we'll have it. So it'll be there. And then Hal Bennett goes and is like, well, I like that. But what if we decided we wanted like a teenage Spock? So I'm going to shoot this other sequence, which he took the torpedo and put it in the middle of like Buena Park and put some plants around it. Yeah. And he shot that, and that was added to the film. And that's where Miles and Bennett sort of clashed a little bit, is because for the purposes of his film, it should end with Kirk on the bridge and Nimoy doing the final,
yes,
you know, space, you know, the intro.
Yeah.
So that's sort of where the clash, like he understands, like for the sake of the franchise. So this is like one of the first cases of franchise, you know, solving the franchise over solving the needs of the film.
Yeah, you've killed off the character.
When you watch a Marvel movie, like, all right, what are you doing for the overall story and what do you need for this movie?
Right.
And that's sort of where that happened. And they didn't know what they would do. They were going to have, it was shot around that they'd have a teenage Spock come out of that. Or like if Nemo didn't want to do it, they can have a version of Spock come out. Or, so, you know.
So in many ways, there's kind of two different directions to bring back Spock. You can physically regenerate his body, or you can put his mind into a clone or something.
Yeah.
And so they kind of create two different possible solutions and just punt it.
Yeah, put his mind into a soon type android. That would be nobody would ever think of doing that. That would be nuts. Whoever would think of doing that would just
it be sounds like some salary, my friend.
A life model decoy.
Yeah, I mean, who would think?
Yeah, so those scenes in particular, the remember sequence, like Nimoy just came up with that on the set. Like that's not in any draft. He was like, just shoot my hand. I'll do a mind meld really quick. And maybe nothing comes of it. Maybe it's just,
okay,
I have a final conversation with McCoy.
Okay, so those are not accidental hints at rebirth. Mm-hmm. Those are placed on purpose.
Yeah,
but they were not completely figured out. They were like hooks dangling.
Because like with this project, like Nimoy signs on to do the movie to do this death scene, like to finally. Yeah. He just wrote the book I Am Not Spock.
Yeah,
he's too flack for that, and he kind of wants to put an end to Spock, but he's having so much fun.
Yeah,
which is not what they were having on the motion picture. Like the motion picture was all steel. Robert Wise really didn't interact with the actors much.
This is something we've learned. This film has more humor than the first movie.
Yeah, and he's like, I'm having a good time making this movie. I don't want the game to end.
If I was feeling sarcastic, I would say no one had fun with the motion picture, but that would be just.
I'm sure someone has fun with that movie. Like that movie, I know for a fact is some people's favorites.
We will be back next week with The Search for Spock. Watch the film if you want, and follow along with us, or let us analyze the crap out of it, and you can watch it when we're done. But anyway, we're glad to see you. Hope to see you again next week. Good night, everyone.
Thank you.